This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Miska allegedly used ChatGPT to generate fake cases to support the father's application to take his children to China for a visit. Global News has learned Miska told the court she was not aware the artificial intelligence chatbot was unreliable, and she did not check to see if the cases actually existed. She has apologized to the court.
If we don't fact check artificially generated intelligence materials and they're inaccurate, it can lead to an existential threat to the legal system.
An Ontario judge recently took counsel to task for a brief that relied on AI-generated cases that turned out to be fake. Hallucinations, in the parlance of artificial intelligence. It wasn't the first time this has happened, but discussion on the intersection between AI and the law, especially with respect to legal services, continues to grow. Professor Abdi Aidid is a law professor at the University of Toronto who has been focused on these issues for many years, well before the public's attention was captured by generative AI services like ChatGPT. Professor Aidid is currently a visiting associate professor of law at Yale Law School. He was a vice president with BlueJay Legal, an early AI legal startup, and is the co-author of The Legal Singularity, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Law Radically Better, which received the Prose Award from the Association of American Publishers and was a finalist for the Donner Prize. He joins me on the podcast to discuss all things AI and the law, including what these technologies may mean for legal practice. Abdi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's a great honor. I'm a longtime listener.
Oh, that's cool. It's really nice to have you on. You've been doing some amazing work, and it's great to have a conversation about it. You know, we're at a moment when there's certainly a lot of excitement, but also a fair amount of negativity and fear with respect to AI, at least certainly around some of the policy and regulatory circles. You strike me as someone who's long been really optimistic about AI, particularly with respect to the legal profession. Now, what sparked this conversation was a recent Ontario decision in which one lawyer is called out for citing in their brief AI hallucinations. Certainly not the first time it's happened, but these mistakes lead me to wonder, you know, how do we make sense of AI in legal practice right now if mistakes like this still keep happening? You started your work on this many years ago before there was a ChatGPT, before many people were really thinking about it. You were a VP of BlueJay Legal. You wrote a book on the legal singularity with respect to how AI, you say, can make law radically better. I want to come a bit to that in a moment. But before we do that, how do you or how did you envision AI reshaping legal practice?
Oh, that's a great question. So I like to think of the possibilities of AI in two different ways. So one is what you might consider a more narrow application of AI, which is professional augmentation, right? It's using the computing power, the capabilities of AI to supercharge lawyer ability, right? So if it's getting you to some legal answers faster because it can help you curate your research more effectively, if it's the fact that AI can synthesize large volumes of data faster than we can, and so it helps you with, say, due diligence, if it's the fact that AI can now engage in some meaningful drafting, using it in certain constrained contexts, that's one category of ways that AI can affect the law. And that is really in helping to provide this big mechanical assist for tasks, right? I think that that is actually the less interesting possibility of AI. The other is really the advent of legal prediction, which involves leveraging advanced data science techniques against significant data sets, for example, case law, and actually trying to forecast legal outcomes, right? And these are things that are increasingly possible with fairly good accuracy, right? So AI can ingest all of the historical case law in a given area and suggest to you how courts are likely to rule in a given case, right? That's a different kind of mechanical assist than the task automation in the sense that, one, it really goes to the heart and soul of what lawyers purport to do, right? Our job in a lot of ways are forecasters. If someone knocks on your door and asks a question, a legal question, they'd be upset if you just recited the multi-part test for whatever. They kind of want to know what's going to happen, what can I do? And AI can help get you part of the way there. And so that's a challenge for us. And the other thing is, for the good Holmesians that are listening, right? Some of you will recall that Holmes famously described the law as the prophecies of what courts might do and nothing more pretentious. And so in a lot of ways, what we've been trying to do all along is trying to forecast outcomes, and technology allows us to do that. In relatively decent measure. And so for me, almost all of the legal, ethical, policy issues in the future are likely to be generated out of that second category. I think the professional augmentation piece is really something that we're going to absorb over time. We're going to work out the contradictions. There's going to be a messy interregnum. We're seeing it now with people kind of falling on their face in certain scenarios. But it's highly unlikely we're going to struggle with that any more than we're struggling with, say, the technologization of the workplace when email or the internet came about, right? At some point, we're going to figure out ways to accommodate that. This second category, which is about using AI to actually do a growing slice of the synthesis, the judgment, the analysis, the things that we really hang our hat on, that to me is going to be the one that's a particular challenge because we need safeguards, we need an ecosystem of support, we need rules, we need a framework. We need to recognize that, hey, if you rush this too soon, you might do things like perpetuate bias and discrimination, for example, right? And so for me, I would encourage listeners to think about it in those two categories and recognize that one, I think, is more deeply fraught than the other in the long term.
Okay, that's super interesting. I'm just coming off a course where AI regulation was a particular focal point. And with law students, one of the focal points for them or sources of concern for them is what does all this mean for their careers? And there was this sense that particularly the first bucket that you talked about in terms of the tasks was top of mind because some of those tasks often fall to articling students and junior
Right.
associates in terms of some of that kind of work. And so they wonder, what does that mean for them in the profession? But of course, you've highlighted that in many ways, the more profound one may be the second group, which then affects the entire stack, so to speak, when it comes to lawyers. How do you see that aspect affecting sort of the future of the legal profession? We're training future lawyers. How will this affect their prospects and how people function within the legal system?
Another great question. I'll start by saying I'm not one of the doomsday scenario folks when it comes to lawyers being replaced. I actually don't think that's likely to happen for a couple of reasons. Well, one is in the short and medium term, AI is probably going to create more legal problems than it's immediately resolving, right? And so, yeah, there might be some efficiency gains when we think about us leveraging the tools effectively, and that depends on us having appropriate ethical rules to do so. But at the same time, AI is significantly challenging intellectual property, tort law. I mean, every self-driving vehicle on the road is a challenge to our traditional negligence regimes, right? And so lawyers are going to be the people that are helping us work out all of what that's going to look like. And it's just generating legal claims all along the way. And so in the short and medium term, there's going to be probably an explosion in cases and in work that relates to contending with these issues. And that also is true at the level of automating tasks. So I'll give you an example. There's a law firm that was doing a test. It wanted to test how effective AI was against its associates at identifying problematic clauses in contracts, right? And so these are lawyers that are working on, mergers and acquisitions. And so they effectively would race the AI to in a test. I'm simplifying, but race the AI in a test to identify who's more effective at finding the problematic clauses. Now, the AI was moderately more effective, right, at identifying the problematic clauses, but it was also faster. It didn't need coffee, didn't need reassurance, didn't need to go to sleep, didn't need a nap, etc. But the situation was that the way it typically worked is on that kind of deal, lawyers themselves would only review a sampling of cases, right? The cases that, sorry, sampling of contracts, those that are above a certain materiality threshold. So when the law firm went back to the client and said, hey, the AI actually performed better than our associates, the client didn't say, okay, replace the lawyers with the AI. The client said, forget the materiality threshold, right? Let's not act like we have any cognitive limitations anymore. Let's review all the contracts as opposed to a sampling. So there's a way in which layering these computational tools on top of the work that we're already doing is going to actually probably in the short term force us to end up doing a lot more work, right? Because we're going to have to sort of cover that spread. So for instance, if I'm asked to do some legal research right now, the principles of stare decisis might counsel me to read a certain sampling of cases, the most relevant cases, right? Well, what if you can get to a place where the technology can help you review all the cases ever decided in that area, right? That might shorten the time to completion of the task, but you might end up actually reviewing more volumes of material. So there's a way in which those efficiencies are going to lead some reconfiguration in the way that we do our work, and in where we recognize that we maybe don't have the limitations we used to, and so maybe we can extend and do even more. I think that's especially true in situations where lawyers are in volume as opposed to margin kind of businesses. So if you're a personal injury lawyer, immigration lawyer, certain kind of immigration law, excuse me, lawyers that are involved in certain tasks where the rate limiting factor on how much, say, money you can make is how many of these you can do in a day, they might just end up actually taking on more, which is what some of the early returns are suggesting. So there's that. There's the fact that efficiencies might, instead of allowing us to pass on those savings and time savings down to the lawyers, will actually lead us to maybe do more. And then finally, I think this is the most significant one. Never underestimate the ability of a professional regulatory regime to protect its core interests, right? And so I think it's quite possible that the moment that this really starts to crest and become this existential threat, that our guild, so to speak, is going to mobilize against it, right? The antibody response is real and has real potential. Now, that can be exhausting, and that probably won't be forever, but in the short and medium term, I think that it, these the checks against the runaway AI are going to be meaningful. And I should also add this, which is if we all today said, let's automate all of our business, let's just be robot lawyers from here on out, there probably wouldn't be enough tools for us to totally do that, right? So the technology has to mature also. So I think in the short and medium term, there's really no grand risk of replacement. In the long term, I think there's a bigger risk of reconfiguration than replacement. And part of that has to do with the fact that in law, the things that we do are not all reducible to ones and zeros, right? We talked about a predictor earlier. Well, how can I create a predictor tool for, say, charter litigation, right? How do I encode the, prevailing political winds or the mood of the court or the particular consensus building practices that happen during deliberations, right? There's always things that are going to escape the, to simplify the sort of binary code that the AI might require. And in some ways, lawyers are going to be increasingly relied on to make sense of those things. So I'm actually quite hopeful. In some ways, there's a possibility that lawyering can evolve and be more dynamic. I didn't go to law school to spend day and night in the case law universe trying to find the one case that the partner suggests actually exists and I'm increasingly suspecting doesn't exist, right? I wanted to do justice. I wanted to have a rhetorical flourish in the courtroom. I wanted to solve problems. I wanted to help people. And I think if we get to a place where we're automating more of the quote unquote drudgery involved in the law, and we can figure out what the intelligent division of labor is between human and machine, then lawyering can be more interesting and dynamic too.
Okay. That's a big sigh of relief, I think, for some in terms of some of the a more optimistic take on where this goes. You mentioned personal injury lawyers, immigration lawyers. It does strike me when we start thinking about these tools, especially as they become more advanced, it raises questions of access. Access both in terms of the legal community's access to these tools and the affordability of these tools, as well as ultimately, I guess, the public from an access to justice perspective. Why don't we touch on both of those for a moment? Your first example was M&A transaction. That sounds like, big law getting involved in these kinds of things. Is there a risk of sort of creating a further divide in some ways between some of the larger firms that may invest very heavily in this, see sort of the positive and say, there's an economic opportunity here, a competitive advantage we might have if we use AI more effectively, so we're going to invest quite heavily in it, contrasted with some smaller firms or other firms that don't have those same kinds of resources. And so for them, AI may prove to, there may be economic barriers to being able to adopt it.
Absolutely. I mean, technology in general is a frontier for massive amounts of inequality. And the law is not going to be any exception. Because actually, the advantages on two fronts that, say, large firms might have over, let's say, the rest of us, right? One advantage, of course, is their ability to procure state-of-the-art tools. Another advantage is that they have, they're sitting on real meaningful data that acts as sort of you almost want to call it the fuel for these tech tools. It's almost like if we're all in a race to buy oil rigs, there's some people that are buying them that are also sitting on top of untapped natural resources, natural oil resource. It's a clunky analogy, but the point here is that the disadvantage and the asymmetry can be really, really perpetuated, especially now, because what's happening now is something very interesting, Michael, where it almost feels as though the tools, at the very time where the costs of developing them are declining, the actual price to the consumer seems to be going up a little bit. I think because there's, in real estate, they talk about price discovery, right? The time it takes for the market to realize what the appropriate price should be. I think a lot of technology companies, AI developers are realizing that they maybe priced the stuff too low, right? So think about it. If let's just say a new lawyer is getting paid $100,000, a new corporate lawyer. Well, if you're developing a tool that purports to displace some 70% of their work, then maybe you should be charging 70,000 as opposed to 999 per month, right? And so I think a lot of technology companies are starting to think that through. GPT has its freemium, notorious freemium model. But the latest version where they're trying to debut some of their new models are charging people $200 a month, right? That wasn't the promise on day one, right? And so I think that there's significant risk, but here's how technology is different than, say, books or our former physical media, is that over time there ends up being market consolidators. I'll give you an example that brings this, I think, into really sharp focus. So in the late 1990s, it might have cost $250,000 to develop a e-commerce website. Right, you had to go see a designer. You had to get an HTML coder, let's say, and to just to have a serviceable website, it would involve that much upfront dollar investment. Right, today you can go on Squarespace or Wix or Google Sites, and it costs about $10 a month, and you can do in this no-code apparatus a pretty decent website, at least one that's passable. Right, but in between that, you had again the messy interregnum. Do you remember, Michael, the days of let's say Angelfire and GeoCities,
Of
or
course.
Blogspot, when you used to go on a website and it wouldn't be perfectly optimized depending on the browser you're on, and maybe it would play music when you go on a page, right? Now today, browsing was kind of miserable for a generation. Now today, whether you're a kid using a free public terminal in a public library, or if you're the most sophisticated computer engineer, your browsing experience is pretty good, right? But it takes market consolidators over time to be able to deliver the quality at a low enough price. And so I think we're approaching the sort of Angel Fire GeoCities era of AI right now, where because the costs have been brought down to develop, people are, there's less quality control, but also because there hasn't been price discovery, it's all over the map in terms of what's becoming available. I think it'll take time, maybe even a generation, before we get the market consolidators that are able to deliver good enough stuff at a low enough price.
That's a fun analogy for sure. What do you foresee this the same kind of thing taking place with respect to access to justice? You mentioned the immigration lawyer or personal injury lawyer taking on more by using these kinds of tools. That suggests there's the ability to lower costs to clients if they wish, if they have that lower volume, or of course they may try to keep it and generate more revenues. But either way, what does this mean for access to justice? Are we in a similar state where those costs, it may not affect costs initially, but ultimately it will have some kind of impact in terms of access to justice, both in terms of the ability to access legal information and the affordability of some of those services?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, certainly, the truth of the matter is that AI does raise the floor in terms of what's possible. And so, for instance, small example, you can draft a fairly okay statement of claim by simply describing the nature of your grievance to a tool like ChatGPT, and it would meet some of the procedural formalities. Now, it wouldn't be good. It might, after some revision, be workmanlike. right? But think about this. Think about a self-represented litigant, right? You and I both know that there isn't a single self-rep that doesn't know why they're mad. They know exactly why they're mad. In fact, they have an intimate sense of their grievance. They can better articulate why they're upset than anybody else. You know, my landlord worked me over, or my job is stealing my wages, or what my neighbor's bothering me, whatever it may be. They understand their grievance intimately. Their problem is that they can't translate that into a way that's legible for our Byzantine legal process. And so, just as a matter of fact, tools like GPT can help you do that. Now, the problem is that they, along the way, will import other issues, right? You know, they decontextualize, they are prone to hallucination, et cetera, et cetera. But the question is no longer, should we restrain the use of it? The question is, can we promote more responsible use of it, given that it can raise the floor for these kinds of litigants? In terms of more general access to justice, across the board, I think one major prospect is bringing down the cost, especially in sort of quote unquote volume legal business. I mean, the challenge here is that the public doesn't have a ton of faith in the legal profession. I mean, Michael, the you know AI has been effective at identifying cancerous lesions and radiological scans for 15 years, but there isn't a single person that doesn't want a cancer diag that wants a cancer diagnosis from an AI. Right? People don't want to replace doctors, right? But for some reason, they're almost desperate to replace us. Part of that is that we took this great public good, law and justice, whatever you might define it as, and are mediating it through a public market that isn't delivering on people's needs. A private market, excuse me, it's not delivering on people's needs. You know, in my years as a commercial litigator, I was never able to afford myself, right? I could never really hire myself, right? And that's kind of a problem. And so I think the concern for the legal profession is people are going to try to self-remedy given that problem. And so we can do two things. We can complain when the cases come before us and they're chock full of errors and hallucinations, or we can say there's a responsible, safe on-ramp. That's only part of it, though. I think the bigger question for us going forward is, can we figure out ways to use this stuff for dispute resolution in ways that can bring down not just the cost, but can unclog the docket, so to speak, right? Like maybe we start doing things like the same way we tried mandatory mediation in Ontario in the late 1990s. We talk about piloting some kind of AI-informed small claims process, for example, right? And we kind of see, how do we reconfigure this in a way where we reserve the disputes that do require our attention for our courts. But there might be ones where people even could voluntarily opt into some kind of algorithmic dispute resolution process, right? And in those kinds of cases, we can dispense quote unquote AI justice. Now, obviously, we'd have to have things like robust appeals mechanisms. We would have to have assistance for folks that are navigating the process on their own so that we don't replicate the same problems that we have now with self-represented litigants, et cetera, right? I'm curious about the ways that we might be able to reconfigure courts themselves, as opposed to think about these as tools that people can use privately in their homes.
That's just so interesting. I mean, it does sound like it's segueing a little bit into your book on legal singularity, where you talk about a state, I'll just quote, a stable and complete legal order capable of addressing and resolving practically all types of legal uncertainty in real time and on demand. Can you expand a little bit? Is that what you're thinking of in terms of some of the dispute resolution, some of the other sorts of issues, or what are some of the implications of this, and what do you see this involving?
Sure. Yeah. So the book has a subtitle that does a lot of heavy lifting, which is how artificial intelligence can make the law radically better. And the word "can" is clear there because we don't take for granted, despite the title maybe suggesting that we're evangelists. We don't take for granted that we're necessarily going to do it, right? Because there's all kinds of ways in which we might not land the plane, right? I mean, actually, just to extend this plane analogy, I think of AI the way I think of air travel, right? It's maybe the fastest way to get from point A to point B over a long distance. But sometimes, you know, over short distance travel, you might want to take the scenic route. You might want to take a train. There's a more effective way. So I think of it as a possibility along a menu of options, number one. And number two, when you get on a plane, you want to know there's someone in the cockpit, and you want to know that there's a regulator that is setting rules, and you want to know there's flight schools, and you want to know someone's checking that the screws are tightened, et cetera. And so I like to think of it that way. So in that context, in a context where we have appropriate constraints and where we take the concerted efforts to design tools in ways that are intelligent, we have the possibility of a stable legal order. Why? Because if we can forecast legal outcomes, if we can get to a place where we can sort of stipulate what the law is, as opposed to trying to engage in this laborious process of trying to put our finger on it, then maybe we can get to a place where people have a real sense of their legal rights and obligations everywhere on demand, right? And where law can be functionally complete, right? So think about it this way. One of the great frustrations that people might have, actually, I'll give you another simple example. We teach a case called Blackwater versus Plint, a very famous Supreme Court case involving historic sexual abuses of First Nation students at the Alberni Indian Residential School in BC. Now, it's nominally a negligence case. It's actually about the contours of vicarious liability, et cetera. Now, if I handed that case, the Supreme Court case, to a non-lawyer and I said, give this a read, it might take them a while before they figure out that what's at stake are the rights of children that were abused at the Alberni Indian Residential School, right? And it's about holding the Church of Canada, the government of Canada, to account for this, historic ill that they are alleged to have assisted in perpetuating, right? Now, the problem, of course, is that we spend most of these cases trying to exactly clarify the contours of the doctrine, right? We're trying to establish what vicarious liability looks like. We're trying to establish the contours of negligence in this particular context. We're trying to figure out how to attribute certain facts related to supervision and control and impute them to the superior party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a way in which almost everything we do in the law, when we're trying to identify legal answers, does abstract a little bit away from what's actually going on. And that can be frustrating in a lot of ways for a lot of people. At a minimum, it makes it difficult for the public to really apprehend what's going on in our courts. And so maybe we can get to a place where if the law can become more predictable to us, right? If we can better forecast what the law says, then we can perhaps get to a place where we can engage in the second order conversations around maybe what the law ought to be. Right. I don't think it's a mistake that a case like Brown versus Board of Education in the US, courts were able to mount this important social intervention, in part because there was absolute clarity about what the law was. They knew separate, there was the doctrine of separate but equal in the background, right? And so you were able to zag because you weren't there, there wasn't the obscurantism that could exist when you're just trying to say put your finger on what the law actually is, right? And so there's that possibility. There's a possibility of just improved civic understanding of what your legal rights and obligations are. If you're someone that is operating a small business, if you're someone who is engaging in any kind of behavior that is in the context of maybe some regulated environment, it maybe would help with your social planning to be able to understand exactly what your constraints are, exactly where the fault lines are, as opposed to being sort of walking into potential landmines, and that can create some significant waste. It's also the possibility of us thinking of disputes as kind of besides the point, right? Thinking about social life as maybe the way that we resolve most things, right? It's about maybe getting us out of the courts for most major disputes because, as it turns out, these are easy cases, right? And maybe it's about reserving our critical institutions for the kinds of cases that require significant deliberation, that require us to work out social and political rights, for example, that resolve keeping the courts not only for those difficult cases, but also the ones where parties insist on maybe pursuing their dignitary or expressive interests, right? And so it's really trying to imagine another world that we argue is actually technologically possible because of the increases in computing power, the capacity of these new data science techniques to forecast legal outcomes. And we think because of the propensity of just the general public to want to maybe push us and nudge us in the direction of lower cost legal services. So the picture of the legal singularity is a prospective future state, right? But it's a lot like when people talk about things like, let's say, think about a conversation raging among students is prison abolition, for example. People say things like, do you want to abolish prisons? Many people instinctively would say no, but they might agree in eliminating cash bail, having more work release, right? And so in some ways, it's about anchoring a conversation at a point in the future that we can coalesce around, and then taking the constituent steps along the way.
Okay, well, I mean, totally fascinating. As we're trying to get to that point, you've talked a lot about how this might influence sort of the courts at the moment in the courts, and I mentioned it off the top. We still have these kind of hallucination cases and other sorts of struggles to deal with some of these technologies. You mentioned that bucket of activity, that world of activity, may require some new regulations and guidelines. In the recent Ontario case, Coe versus Lee, the court states, and I'll quote, that it must quickly and firmly make clear that regardless of technology, lawyers cannot rely on non-existent authorities or cases that say the opposite of what is submitted. Now, that would seem like a given, one would think. But court makes it clear because literally, we've got lawyers who are doing precisely that. What are some of the kinds of regulations, guidelines, or other kinds of things that you're thinking about to not just address the sort of hallucinations which you'd hope professionalism would deal with, but more broadly in terms of as we potentially move to this different world where the legal profession finds itself right in the middle, but there may well need to be some kinds of guidelines, guardrails, regulations, and the like.
Oh, we're going to need a ton of rules. Let me start by saying, on the point of hallucinations, this to me is a classic example of us taking, the making this a conversation about technology really takes us off the hook. It's sometimes when I'm talking about AI, lawyers will ask me, "Hey, if I take a client's information and I put it in ChatGPT and it ends up being in a cyber attack or it ends up getting leaked, what ethical rule am I running afoul of?" And I'll say, "Hey, you don't need a newfangled technological rule. You're running afoul of the competence rule in that context." And the hallucinations is a great example of that. Why? Because it flows from a fundamental misapprehension of what these large language models are doing. If the audience remembers nothing else from today, remember this. A tool like GPT is generally not a research tool, right? It is at best a probabilistic determination of the next likely word. Okay, so language model, not knowledge model, right? What's the difference? Well, just to hyper simplify, what a tool like GPT does is it ingests all this data. Let's say it's trained on the sum total of internet information. But what it's trying to divine from that information is not the underlying truth of any of those data points. It's the parts of speech, the syntax, the diction, the language generation capacity, right? And so when you're asking it a question, it's not trying to necessarily give you a direct answer to that question. It might if it knows it, if it happens to know it, but if it doesn't, it'll give you a compelling answer to that question because it understands how people interact. So I liken it to asking a really smart person locked up in a basement, surrounded by books, what's the weather today? Right? They might even be surrounded by books about meteorology and climate science, right? But they haven't been outside. Right? And so they can't give you the answer, but they know exactly what an answer to that question is would be, right? You can test this out by asking it GPT an idiom that you make up, right? You'd be like, "Hey, what does it mean to rub yourself bald?" Right? It'll give you an earnest response, like, "Oh, rubbing yourself bald means, when you're frustrated and you're working, burning the midnight oil, working long hours, you're tearing your hair out." It's not a thing that we say, but it nevertheless wants to respond. And in that way, you might think of it a little bit, with due respect to junior associates, interns, you might think of it the way you think about a really talented young lawyer that you work with, right? They're eager to please, they're available around the clock, but how would you treat their work? You would trust but verify, right? You would never just pass it along without double checking the source material. In this case, pro tip, double check any underlying factual assertions offered to you by an AI tool. And so for me, the error that exists in these cases like Coe versus Lee and in some of the hallucination cases, there's ones involving famous people, Michael Cohen, Roz from the Fugees, the famous one, Avianca case in the United States. There's one happened in BC, Justin Matsuhara dealt with, right? In almost all of those cases, the thing that would have resolved the problem is double checking, right? And so it's not a distinctly AI problem here. And actually, I want to encourage people to think of hallucinations that way. As it happens, there's a unique interest convergence between the smartest people in the world and also maybe the most evil people in the world on rooting out hallucinations. No one wants it. And so everybody is on the same page about reducing the incidence of hallucinations. That's not the immutable problem, because not only do we have our sort of old analog tools are good enough at stopping that from happening. But also the trend or the all of the pressure in the industry is on resolving that issue. Immutable problems are things like deepfaked evidence, right? Because in the same way that technology is conspiring to reduce the incidence of hallucinations, it is conspiring to make deepfaked images even better, even sharper, even more likely to dupe you, right? And so when we think about the possibilities in our court system, right, we have to think about what does a world of adjudication look like in a situation where judges and jurors can't believe their eyes, right? To me, that's a way more serious and more profound question. Actually, this is kind of the rationale for thinking about things in terms of the legal singularity, right? It's about, hey, you know, when you look at technology, the current state of technology, it's like looking at a star through a telescope. You don't know it, but you're looking long time in the past, right? The question is, what's on the horizon? What's coming, right? And so we have to think ahead. The problem is that it kind of feels like science fiction when you think ahead in that way, right? You sound goofy talking about it, right? Where you say, hey, there's going to be AI agents that are going to represent us in court. That sounds silly to people. And then it's totally technically possible today. So the question is, when is there going to be sufficient political and economic will to make it happen? And so this is all me saying we need to actually take a leap forward when we think about regulation. We could engage in the short-termism of rule development for our particular local timely context, but the truth is that our machinery is not fast enough to make the impact that we expect. You know, the American Bar Association is only now promulgating a rule. I think they're meeting in committee this month and for consideration for a rule around deepfaked evidence in 2 months. You know, it's just not good enough, right? And so I think when we think about regulation, the question is, how can we be so imaginative as to have regulation that can endure even as the technological context changes? And for me, that only works from working backwards from harm, right? How we can imagine, we can't imagine the technology, we can imagine all the harms that that technology can create, right? We can imagine things like bias and discrimination existing. We can imagine actual people's health and physical safety being affected. We can imagine things like improper information disclosure. We can imagine things like you know, using AI for targeting and manipulation. We need to think in terms of harm reduction, work backwards from the possibilities of harm, and I think that should be the anchoring principle for any regulation. And Europe's AI Act is a decent model of that, because what Europe is doing in their AI Act is they're creating this tiered system where they're saying, okay, not every AI is created equal. Some demand more scrutiny than others. And so they work in this categorical approach where they say, well, things that operate in the public square and have impact at scale on things like health and safety, those are inherently suspect, so to speak, right? Whereas, you know, low-scale administrative applications of AI that are have discrete cabinet effects, those maybe just require us to have terms of service and policies, right? Whereas that previous category I described might be where we exercise a bit more of a precautionary principle, where we say you have to sort of ex ante demonstrate that these tools work before they can enter the marketplace. We have to think that way. We have to think that way. And we can be a microcosm and model good behavior in the legal community for that by saying all these not all tools are created equal. There's something more problematic about an AI tool that's trying to predict the likelihood of recidivism than an AI tool that's being used for e-discovery. Right? And right now we're having the same conversation about all of it in ways that I think are affecting our ability to create targeted, sensitive, and responsive rules and regulations.
No, that's fair. Certainly the sophistication and even the granularity of some of these discussions just isn't really there.
It is, it, you know, this is a cold comfort for anyone who's been affected by an AI tool or is concerned, but we are at day zero in a lot of ways. Like we're a little bit later than we should be, right? We've been on our back foot and we're reacting to goings on, but it doesn't mean that we need to continue playing catch up, right? I think it's one of those moments where we have to look ahead and look forward and recognize that we are still well positioned to mitigate future risk.
Okay. So we're day zero-ish on the regulatory side. You've been doing this for a long time. Are we moving in terms even of technological adoption of these of these technologies of AI? Are we moving faster than you expected? Is this slower than you expected? Essentially, how quickly is some of this vision, do you think, might it emerge based on sort of the trajectory of what's taking place right now? For some, they're just waking up to all of this just in the last couple of years. You've been there far earlier. Is this happening faster than you thought or slower than you thought?
It's happening faster than I thought, actually. And that's happening on a couple of fronts. One, the tech is more capable at a faster, on a shorter time horizon than even I anticipated, even though I was someone who was saying it's gonna happen tomorrow. Tomorrow came sooner than I expected in a lot of ways. Part of that is a function of the absence of meaningful constraints. There's some good that's been produced, but I'm of course concerned about the fact that this appears not to be deliberate or coordinated and is unconstrained in serious ways. And so that has led to, I think, technology becoming more capable than I anticipated. But also, I think we jumped sooner to different kinds of AI, much more quickly than I thought. So, for example, today's conversation is about generative AI in a lot of ways, but tomorrow is going to be about agentic AI. It's going to be about AI agents that are engaged in undirected, unsupervised, multi-step transactions, right? And that's going to be a major threat to our law. So, for instance, if you can instruct an AI agent to engage in contracting, high volume trading, whatever it may be, well, what does that mean for, the traditional meeting of the minds principles in our contract law, for example, right? Like, there's all kinds of things that this can generate, all kinds of legal questions that can generate at the doctrinal, substantive level, right? Not just working it out in practice. And so I was maybe thinking about this in these contiguous categories where it's like, we're going to figure out machine learning, then we're going to move on to generative AI, then we're going to move on to agentic AI. It's kind of all happening at once at varying rates of speed. And I think that's what's interesting, but it's also what's concerning because, we as lawyers, we're, as much as we think we're precious, we are unique in some ways. We swear an oath, right? We're supposed to be gatekeepers of the rule of law in meaningful measure. But the truth of the matter is that technologists don't have the same compunction as we do about developing some of these tools. And so you might see an increased number of law and law-related tools being developed by technologists that maybe don't have the same professional and ethical obligations as we do, in part because we're not entering those spaces quickly enough or at the rate that they would like. And so I think that's somewhat concerning. And obviously, our adoption as lawyers is I think slower than I would like to see. Not because I think that everyone stands to benefit from using AI necessarily today, but I think if there was a more significant adoption, then we'd be maybe more on the same page around creating rules and constraints. We'd have more of an epistemic community around what responsible AI use looks like. In the legal profession, we haven't really done anything that other industries would recognize as innovation, right? Like, even the machine learning kind of legal prediction I'm describing, those are things that insurance companies were using for claims adjustment in the 60s, right? It's like if you imagine a law school classroom 100 years ago or a courtroom 100 years ago, look largely the same as it does today. There might be some screens for evidence presentation and some laptops, but we haven't done a ton of innovating. And so I'd like to see that speed up, if only because we have a more mature, sophisticated conversation.
Okay. I mean, that last answer sort of anticipates where I wanted to wrap up, which was really talking about what do you think law firms and further law schools ought to be doing? I mean, you talked about adoption, but I guess more broadly, what should law firms be thinking about? And particularly in a law school environment, what are the kinds of things you think our institutions ought to be focused on?
Yeah, this is where I think surprise a lot of people because I get the question of what should law schools do. I actually think that the advent of AI and the application of AI to the law has totally vindicated the traditional legal education model, right? So think about like computer science programs, right? They don't really train students anymore on how to use a given coding language because they recognize that the terrain shifts so quickly, the students have to have skills that endure even as the technology shifts, right? And where you have to have architectural conceptual knowledge so that you can be able to use a variety of different kinds of tools at different times. I think in law schools, if we said we're going to train students on how to use a given AI, I think we'd be making bets on which ones are likely to have a shelf life, and we don't have that information necessarily. You know, since I started working on these issues some years ago, you know, if I started tr teaching my students in 2017, how to use a given AI tool, you know, a lot of those companies have folded, don't exist. A lot of technology we've moved on from. A lot of technology, the user interfaces have changed so much that it would have rendered that training kind of useless. And I'm making a bigger point here, which is not just about we shouldn't train students on how to use a given software. I actually think that the thing that's going to matter is knowledge of the law qua law, right? If I ask GPT or any kind of large language model a family law question, I don't really have any hope of determining whether it's right or wrong. I might have a sense, but if I ask it a privacy question or a torts question or a question that's more in my wheelhouse as an academic, then I can sort of quickly determine its veracity, correctness. You know, I can work with it, and that's just old school legal chops that make the difference. If we're going to be supervising a growing number of technological outputs, then actually old school legal knowledge is kind of what makes the difference in many ways. And I really mean that. You know, I think that everything else I've been saying suggests that I might take a different stance on this. So, I that's a genuine bedrock belief of mine that it's the law qua law that's going to matter. And all the things that attend to that, you know, the legal reasoning, the ability to synthesize information, the critical lens that students might take to information, the fact that you think of the law as messier than ones and zeros, right? I think of, sometimes you might have to negotiate with a probabilistic determination of an AI and say, hey, that's actually not how it might work in this local context because there's all these other things, you know, foreseeability in the tort law is sometimes like plausibility, sometimes like possibility. You know, the all those jagged edges are things that students are going to have to know and understand so that they can be effective interlocutors for the technology and good supervisors to the extent that they will be. I don't know if that's the way it's going to develop. In terms of law firms are going to be asked to do something that I think is, let's call it uneconomical, which is they're going to have to resolve the following problem, which is there might be a future state where AI is more effective than your junior associates at their junior associate tasks. At the same time, you might recognize that trudging through the mud, so to speak, is kind of what makes people good. And so, what exactly are you going to do to augment that loss of training? Now, think about the way that we do it in, I don't know, math, right? We know that calculators help. They help us, you know, the physics survived the calculator. The calculator helped us automate certain computations that allow us to understand more of our natural world and engage in these advanced functions. Like, that's all well and good. But we also restrained the use of the calculator for a certain number of years until kids develop some conceptual arithmetic knowledge, right? Because we say that you're not going to be any good with this thing. We take for granted they're going to use it. We say you're not going to be any good with it unless you understand some basic principles about how it works, and so that you can have enough conceptual knowledge that you can manipulate the tool, and also so you can interact with the world. And so the question is, are law firms going to do the work of, say, restraining the use of AI in those early years for training purposes? I don't know. I really don't know. But that's going to be the survival question, in some ways. If I can drop a few more seconds to make one more point.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
The Michael, there's a bigger challenge that we're dealing with, which is for years, lawyers resisted any kind of meaningful evaluation of what constitutes good lawyering. You know, in medicine, there was a empirical turn, right? And to the point where if you go and present with blood work at five different oncologists, they might generally recommend the same therapeutics and the same interventions. And that is the result of things like standards of practice, standards of care, the fact that they do case studies, the fact that there's a culture of staying on top of literature. All right. There's all these things, right? In law, we've absolutely resisted day-to-day scrutiny of what we do. And in fact, we've especially resisted quantitative evaluation, like, you know, lawyer success metrics. That's understandable for a whole host of reasons. You know, one of the leading reasons that we resist day-to-day scrutiny is for confidentiality. But I would say, hey, maybe medicine has a stronger claim to confidentiality than we do. But law is kind of what they call in economics a credence good. right? It's the kind of good or service where the same person makes the diagnosis, sets the price, and evaluates the quality, right? Now that's concerning in the context of AI, right? You go to your mechanic and you say, "Hey, my wipers aren't working," and your mechanic says, "Hey, your brake pads are also worn and your transmission's blown." And because you don't have the information at that moment, unless you're willing to go and get a second opinion, you might accept it. Then what that same mechanic will set the price for you, right? And because you don't have, it compounds that information asymmetry. And unless you're going to the price shop, you might accept it. But the worst of all is that you're not going to know if they did a good job until you break down the highway months later. Law's a little bit of that example where we do the diagnosis, we tell people what work, what constituent steps are involved in discharging our lawyerly obligation, we set the price for it, and we're the ones who ultimately evaluate the quality and determine whether it was good or not. The problem with us not having rigorous evaluation metrics, let's call it quantitative or qualitative, is that now technologists are making claims that we don't have information to resist. So they're saying things like AI does it better, and we're like, no, it doesn't, right? But how do we finish the rest of that paragraph when we say no, it doesn't, right? If a technologist that we don't respect comes and says AI is better at writing factums than lawyers are, right? We don't really have good information to resist that. We have a strong sense. We have a deeply held intuition. We might even have subjective impressions when we read the text. We don't have the kind of information that wins the battle in the public square in those critical moments, right? And so I think at bottom, the profession does have to change a little bit of its attitude towards itself, right? Because I think that we are weaker, we are more vulnerable than we necessarily had to be, in part because we engage in all the self-interested behavior along the way, right? I happen to believe that an AI can draft a factum as well as a moderately trained lawyer can today. I happen to believe that's the case. But it would have been nice if we had developed some principles on by which to resist the claim, right? And I think we did a lot to undercut ourselves for this moment. And it maybe rolls up into the question of why people don't want to get rid of doctors, but they seem to be desperate to get rid of lawyers.
Wow. If we're akin to car mechanics, that may help explain some of the frustration as well. But it's clearly not just a fascinating area, but this is a truly fascinating discussion. You're really operating and thinking sort of at the edge of where these technologies intersect with law and the legal profession. It's so interesting. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast to discuss.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me. Great discussion.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or follow Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.